Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name's Rob Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And today on the show, we're going to be talking about a movie from 1966, a film called Seconds, directed by John Frankenheimer. And I was trying to think what to call it. Would you call this a science fiction thriller or a philosophical horror thriller? This really does defy genres in a way.
It really does. I mean, you can see there are elements of conspiracy drama, conspiracy thriller there. There are elements of sci-fi and horror, but it's not really any of those things. It is deeply psychological in many respects. So you might say it's psychological A, B, or C. But any attempt to pin this film down is going to miss something crucial, I think.
So I'm really excited to talk about this movie. I'm honestly astounded how interesting I found it. But I do want to issue a sort of dual warning here at the top. First of all, about the podcast episode, this film has some, I would say, extremely powerful twists and surprises in it. And in order to talk about the movie in detail, we have to sort of reveal those surprises, including the ending, a little later in our conversation. So if you want to watch it spoiler-free and preserve your surprise, you should do that before listening. But secondary warning, before you go off to do that, I also have to say I was absolutely floored by the ending of this movie. And I don't usually feel the need to issue like warnings just about a movie having disturbing content or being really unsettling. But, we cover a lot of weird horror and stuff. But this one was like, it shook me so hard that I feel like I should give people a bit of a heads up. Especially because I think you're not really expecting it given the context. This movie is from 1966. It's shot in black and white. The cinematography is amazing. It looks like a film from a little bit earlier. Like it looks like it could be a really well shot, interesting looking film from the 50s. It stars Rock Hudson. So that really also makes it feel like, I don't know, one of these kind of romantic comedy movies from the 50s or something. But I think especially given all that context, I was just not prepared for the raw horror and desperate bleakness achieved by the end of this film. So if you watch it, prepare to be shaken.
Yeah, this movie is a 60s film that looks in many respects like a 1950s movie, but ultimately has the feel of a 70s or even 80s film in terms of its impact.
I guess I could worry that on the other end, I might be kind of diminishing the dramatic effect by giving this warning, but so be it. I was shocked by the ending, and I was kind of like walking around the house feeling a pit in my stomach afterwards. So if people are going to go off and watch this, be prepared.
Yeah, I was finishing watching this movie after my son came back from summer camp, and I was like watching it in the living room, but with headphones in, and right as everything was going down, and I was like prepared to jump up and like like pause the movie and stop him from entering the room, just because I was like, this is too disturbed.
Exactly. Right after I finished, I was going to go play with my baby, and it's just. I mean, I guess that's a good thing to do, actually, because I want to say, but on the other hand, I don't want to scare people off too much, because I think Seconds is a phenomenal film. I had never seen it before we watched it this week for the show. I understand it received, I think, a very polarized reaction from critics back when it was first released. I think some thought it was a kind of strange masterpiece. Others thought it was cold and even reprehensible. And I didn't fully understand this division in opinion while I was watching it until the ending, and then it made sense. But I think I would side more with the supporters. In my opinion, Seconds is a piercing, fascinating look at the nature of desire. This is a film about what it means to want things and to want something different for your life. And it explores the really complex, troubling hidden architecture underneath the visible edifice of all those desires.
Yeah. I won't say anything more about the ending until we get to it, but I will say it's not a gut punch ending. It's not one of those undeserved gut punch endings anyway. I think it is, as you're there on the floor holding your stomach, you realize, no, that gut punch was warranted.
Yeah.
and is supported by the film. Now, one thing that I think is interesting to point out, and this is purely accidental, but I think Seconds is in many ways an interesting companion piece to The Incredible Shrinking Man from 1957 that we recently talked about on the show. They both deal with themes of mid-century, midlife crisis and fantastic treatments of desired or undesired change. In The Incredible Shrinking Man, our protagonist is literally diminished and ultimately reaches a point of acceptance and ultimately even transcendence. Seconds, however, deals with the siren song of escape and liberation from one's own life and is ultimately a far darker tale.
Agree 100%. These are both excellent movies and offer really interesting philosophical counterpoints to one another.
My elevator pitch is feature-length Twilight Zone midlife crisis.
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and hear the audio from the trailer.
Bizarre. Terrifying. Rock Hudson, in an astonishing change of pace, stars in Seconds. Rock Hudson as a second, freed from all responsibilities, now ready to taste new pleasures. Rock Hudson, as a man who buys for himself a totally new life, a chance to begin again, every man's dream since time began.
As soon as these people leave, I'm going to attack you. I want you to know that.
I'm counting on it.
Rock Hudson, as a man who lives the nightmare of being a second.
Why are you all staring at me like that? Hey, John. Why are they staring at me like that?
They know.
They know what?
They're like you. Reborns.
Oh, Laura!
All All right. Now, if you're eager to go out and see this film for yourself before we discuss it any further, and this would be a good place to do that, because after this, you know, we're going to start getting into the characters and into the plot. And even in discussing the characters, we're going to spoil a few things for you. So, go out and see it if you're interested. It's widely available on digital, and it was released on Blu-ray as part of the Criterion Collection. So, it's a film that, despite its seeming mixed reviews when it came out, or mixed reception critically and so forth, it has developed a cult following over the decades, and I think is largely very well received and admired today.
Yes, I think it really aged into proper acclaim.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about some of the folks involved in making this picture. Starting at the top, we mentioned that this is a John Frankenheimer film. He directed it. Frankenheimer lived 1930 through 2002, started out in TV in the mid-50s and directed 26 episodes of Climax! He made his film directorial debut with 1957's The Young Stranger, a drama starring Kim Hunter. In the 60s, though, he really came into his own, first with The Young Savages, a 1961 street gang flick starring Burt Lancaster as a district attorney, not as a troubled youth, I should say, because I don't know if Burt Lancaster ever was a youth. He also did a trio of films in 1962, All Fall Down with Warren Beatty, Birdman of Alcatraz with Lancaster and Carl Malden, and The Manchurian Candidate starring Frank Sinatra and Angela Lansbury. That is probably one of his more famous films.
Well, it's a very different kind of genre and subject matter. I would say one thing that is shared in common between Manchurian Candidate and Seconds is the atmosphere of secretiveness and paranoia that is conjured in both films.
Yeah, yeah. After this came 1964, 7 Days in May. This is about a military coup taking place in the United States. Which I think also has similar strains, you know, obviously of conspiracy and so forth and paranoia. And then a film called The Train, which I think is maybe a little less on the intrigue and conspiracy spectrum. And then comes the movie Seconds. Frankenheimer continued to work steadily throughout the rest of his life, and some of the standouts include 75's The French Connection 2, 1977's Black Sunday. This was the first film adaptation of a Thomas Harris novel. The 1979 Mutant Bear movie Prophecy, which we've mentioned a few times on the show before.
Seems to come up frequently, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a mutant bear movie directed by John Frankenheimer. I still haven't seen it all the way. I started watching it and then realized it was maybe too serious for what I had in mind for myself. Mm. He directed the 1982 John Salis scripted action movie The Challenge, starring Scott Glenn and Toshiro Mifune. 1994's The Burning Season, starring Raul Julia. He, of course, stepped in to replace Richard Stanley on 1996's The Island of Dr. Moreau. And then he also directed 1998's Ronin, which is a pretty entertaining espionage thriller, as I recall. It's got a really solid cast and some excellent vehicular stunts.
I think that's one of those movies I saw when, I was like too young to understand the plot at all. But I do remember like Robert De Niro and Sean Bean and Stellan Skarsgård.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to understand the plot of Ronin, really. It's just, you know, various spy types are encountering each other, saying cryptic things, and then stuff gets blown up and so forth. All right, the screenplay for this film was written by Louis John Carlino, lived 1932 through 2020, American screenwriter and director. He'd written for TV previously, but this was his first feature screenplay credit, but certainly not the last. His later screenplays include 1972's The Mechanic, and 1979's The Great Santini, starring Robert Duvall. This was based on the Pat Conroy novel, and Carlino also directed that film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this film, Seconds, is based on the novel by David Ely, born 1927. The only other adaptation of his work that I ran across is a 1971 segment on Night Gallery titled The Academy, starring Pat Boone. I think I've seen this one because I think it's season one, but I don't remember it at all. Seconds was a 1963 novel, and his other works include 68's Time Out and 1992's A Journal of the Flood Year. All right, getting into the cast here, and yeah, there are going to be some spoilers as we discuss like who each of these people is playing. We have this character named Arthur Hamilton. He's the initial incarnation of our protagonist, a successful man who's deeply uncomfortable in his own life and completely bottled up emotionally. It is, in my opinion, just a really great performance by the actor John Randolph, who lived 1915 through 2004.
Agree that the cast is excellent across the board, I think. Really, everybody who gets speaking roles in this is very good. But the two actors playing the protagonist are, I think, should be singled out for really high praise.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a performance doesn't exist in isolation. Randolph's performance here is accentuated by great direction, great cinematography. But man, it really all comes together in this very uncomfortable and at times like really surprisingly raw, like emotionally raw and also just paranoia inducing performance.
Yeah.
So Randolph was born Emmanuel Hirsch Cohen and was active on Broadway as far back as 1938, according to the Internet Broadway database. And his earliest TV and film credits go back to 48 and 49. But he and his wife, Sarah Cunningham, were both blacklisted around that time. And in 1955, they were both called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. As such, Randolph was forced to work outside of Hollywood and New York film, television, and radio for a good 15 years.
Man, I feel like HUAC has been coming up a lot in Weird House episodes recently. That's not by design. It just happens to be.
No, it just happens. It seems like it's a case of watching, you know, meaningful films with talented folks in them from this time period. It ended up impacting so many people, either the blacklist or the gray list or the ramifications of those lists. So anyway, he continued working in New York theater. I don't think that was like directly impacted, but may have been indirectly. But his TV and film credits are pretty lackluster up until the mid-60s. And this film, Seconds, was his first real film role coming out of that blacklist period. Now, after Seconds, he did a lot more TV work, including Night Gallery, and played the chairman in two Planet of the Apes movies, Escape and Conquest, that's 71 and 72. He was in Serpico in 73, the Al Pacino cop movie. He was in the 76 King Kong film, Heaven Can Wait in 78, Pritzi's Honor in 85. Oh, I didn't recognize him at all from this, but he was in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation in 89, playing Clark Griswold Sr.
No memory of that, though. I've seen that movie.
Yeah. He was in You've Got Mail in 98, and he played the original Frank Costanza on Seinfeld. I either didn't know or had forgotten that this was ever a case of someone else ever having played the plot before Jerry Stiller. And I couldn't find a clear answer. It seems like it might have been just scheduling issues that the reason they ended up replacing him as playing Frank Costanza. But it also may have been a desire to go in a new direction with the character. I'm not sure. I can't really imagine him being Frank Costanza long term on the show. Likewise, I can't imagine Jerry Stiller playing this role in this movie. So,
you know, I really want to give credit to Randolph in this role because he's very good. And in many ways, it's a thankless kind of performance because it's very complex and he's pitch perfect in it. But it's a role where he doesn't really get to branch out and like offer much emotion because like the whole point is that his character is kind of like unfulfilled and unfulfilling. He's just sitting there like containing all of his disappointment within himself and not really getting to express it. And this character does have an arc where he goes other places, but as we're about to reveal in a minute, this actor doesn't get to be there for that.
Yeah. I think the key thing is that as a vessel containing these complex emotions that are just straining to leak out, like you can see that, you can observe that, you can feel that in his performance. And it's not a situation where you just have to imagine, you know, purely imagine what's going on inside. Like you can see the gears turning.
Mm-hmm.
So excellent performance. Absolutely. I don't think I'd really seen much of his work before outside of obviously Christmas Vacation, which, is perfectly fine. I've seen it a million times, but not really a showcase for his work. All right, playing author Hamilton's wife, Emily Hamilton, is Frances Reed, who lived 1914 through 2010. American actor best known in film for her role here, but she also acted in 1971's The Andromeda Strain. Soap opera fans, however, might recognize her from, this is correct, 3,393 episodes of Days of Our Lives,
what?
On which she played Alice Horton from 1965 through 2007.
How is that even possible?
I don't know. It sounds astounding, but I guess they just really cranked these out. I mean, this was like a daily show, right?
That's astounding. I had no idea that show ran that long. But also, I want to say, Frances Reed, extremely good in this movie in a similarly thankless kind of role to John Randolph here, that she, you know, she plays a character whose complexity is a lot in what she doesn't get to say and doesn't get to emote.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think it's also a solid performance, and there's kind of a part one and part two of it that that I think equals things out really well.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
All right. The next character we're going to discuss here has a different name. It's Antiochus Wilson, or Wilson, as he's mostly referred to. This is the reborn Arthur Hamilton. So this is, as we'll explain, this is the character he becomes. He is reborn as this person through surgical reconstruction and through fraudulent documents and so forth. There's a whole organization. We'll get to that. But basically, one character becomes this other take on the character, and a new actor takes over the role. That actor is Rock Hudson, who lived 1925 through 1985.
I'm not super well versed on Rock Hudson's career, but from what I understand, this was a major departure for him, that he had mostly done much lighter movies. You know, he's known as he's a handsome guy. He's there to be the fun, good looking guy in like a romance or romantic comedy or something. To be in a dark, brooding philosophical science fiction film like this, I don't think he'd really done anything like this, had he?
No. I was looking around. I don't think he'd ever done anything that you could classify as horror or science fiction or certainly fantasy. And, you know, part of that, as we've discussed, highly successful actors or directors or what have you of the day, they generally didn't have to do that. It's such an inversion of what we have today, where the biggest actors around are, you know, almost inevitably, with some notable exceptions, obviously. There are no, any of these generalities are not going to be 100%. But, you know, it's not surprising to see someone who's won multiple Oscars show up in a Marvel movie. Or in, or Star Wars or what have you. But back in the day, you know, as we've discussed on these various genre pictures, they were lower down on the pecking order. And so, it's not surprising to find a situation where Rock Hudson had never been in a movie that had robots or aliens or even, you know, the sort of ultimately kind of light, sophisticated sci-fi, you know, kind of more Twilight Zone-ish elements that you find in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, he was a 1950s leading man. Perhaps, not just a, he was kind of the 1950s leading man. He's the top billed actor in this film, and he was easily one of the biggest, if not biggest, movie stars of his era. His main film roles were stuff like, his biggest pictures anyway from the 50s were stuff like All That Heaven Allows, Giant, Written on the Wind, and Pillow Talk. These are all movies where you can pull them up now on the database of your choice, and all the posters prominently feature his character romantically embracing the lead actress. That is not the case with Seconds.
No.
So, going into this was a departure, and I'm to understand that he was not Frankenheimer's first choice for the role. Apparently, Frankenheimer considered Rock Hudson to be maybe a lighter weight actor. Ultimately, you know, he's the rom-com guy. He's the heartthrob guy. He's like, I need somebody like a Burt Lancaster. But ultimately, he gets sold on Rock Hudson. Like his agent says, no, Hudson can do this. He's excited for this role, So Frankenheimer was proved wrong and has admitted as such. I absolutely agree. I think Hudson's performance in this is great. I think he perfectly captures this sense of the reborn in Seconds.
Fully agree. I wouldn't want anybody else in this role. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's playing a character that's outwardly strong and confident. You know, a complete transformation from his previous incarnation, but inside, you know, there's still this uncertainty. There's perhaps this sense of inadequacy, and you can see all of that happening. You know, I was worried, honestly, because the first performance of this character, John Randolph's performance, is so strong. I was like, even not being that familiar with Rock Hudson's work, I was like, I don't know if Hudson's going to really be able to pull this off. Are we going to feel it's going to feel unequal? But I really think that he pulls off a great performance here. I can't imagine it being any different. Now, Hudson would go on to appear in two more films you could qualify as science fiction, 1976's Embryo and 1980's The Martian Chronicles. And various other films. I think he's in an Avalanche movie that was covered on Mystery Science Theater at some point late in his career. Mm. Much has been written about Hudson's personal life as he was a gay man working at a time and in a position that did not permit him to live openly as such. And this is also factored into a fair amount of film analysis, retrospectively concerning Seconds. But any way you shake it, any way you look at it, this is now largely considered to be one of his best performances. I think I read that it's a performance that Hudson himself was very proud of, and I think with good reason.
Hear, hear. Hats off to Rock Hudson.
This is one of those episodes where we don't really get to harp on anybody or critique anybody's performance. It's like every one of them is like, wow, they nailed it. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, that's how it is. It's across the board. I feel like everybody did great, great work here.
Now, up next, we have Salome Jens playing Nora Marcus, born 1935. American modern dancer turned actor of stage, screen, and TV. Her first major role was playing the future woman in 1958's Terror from the Year 5000, a movie some of you misties out there might remember from Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's not actually that memorable a film, but a lot of people probably saw it through MST. She played the title role in 1961's Angel Baby, which starred George Hamilton and was the film debut of Burt Reynolds, pre-mustache, of course. She was in 65's The Fool Killer opposite Anthony Perkins. And then comes Seconds, in which she plays this captivating character, Nora, that our protagonist encounters in his new life in Bohemian, California.
She is a self-actualized free spirit who has taken her life into her own hands, and she represents, in a way, I think the potential to live life in freedom and self-determination.
Yeah, she's so alive, but to the degree that, at least through the lens of our main character, you know, she is exciting and full of promise, but also maybe a little bit intimidating and frightening. Mm-hmm. And I think it's all played perfectly. It's a very lively and charismatic performance. So hats off to Salome Jens here. She worked a lot after this, mostly in TV, but her TV credentials are really solid, including The Outer Limits, the original Outer Limits. She was also in a single episode of Tales from the Crypt, Maniac at Large. That one's notable because that one was directed by John Frankenheimer. That was a pretty solid episode. That was one that we actually discussed on a past anthology of horror for Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Oh, okay.
That one had Adam Ant in it, you might recall. She also pops up on Star Trek The Next Generation and also had a more substantial role as the female shapeshifter on 15 episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. She narrated 1986's Clan of the Cave Bear and did other voice work late in her career. All right, so at the heart of this movie, there's a sinister corporation that is called The Company, and it has various individuals working in it. I'm going to go lighter on the backgrounds on these actors just because I don't want to spend the entire podcast just talking about the stellar cast. But heading this up, or seemingly heading this up, is the old man, played by Will Geer, who lived 1902 through 1978. Botanist turned actor and lifelong activist who also found himself blacklisted in 1950s Hollywood after refusing to name names before Congress. Other films of note include 1967's In Cold Blood and 1972's Jeremiah Johnson.
Will Geer really stood out to me. He was perfect in his role. I think we can talk more about him when we get into the plot.
Yeah. We also have a man by the name of Mr. Ruby, played by Jeff Corey. Jeff Corey lived 1914 through 2002, another stage and screen actor blacklisted during the 1950s, also for refusing to name names. He became a noted acting teacher during that period and worked with a number of future stars. His biggest films include 69's True Grit, as well as Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and 1970's Beneath the Planet of the Apes, also the film Little Big Man from 1970. Mm. We also have a character named Dr. Innes. This is the plastic surgeon that works for the company. He was played by Richard Anderson, who lived 1926 through 2017. American actor best known on screen for supporting roles in 58's Paths of Glory, 59's Compulsion, and 56's Forbidden Planet. On TV, he played Oscar Goldman, who was the boss of both the $6 million man and the $6 million woman, or I guess like the $12 million man and woman. There's also another interesting character in the company, a character named Davalo, and he's played by the actor Kai D. He lived 1910 through 1991, an American actor of Anglo-Egyptian Sudanese ancestry who tended to play characters of Asian descent in various pictures and TV projects from 1950 through about 1990. His other big film was 1962's The Manchurian Candidate, where he played the brainwashing expert Dr. Yen Lo.
Oh, yeah. Okay. In this movie, he has an interesting role. It's a very small role, but an interesting moment in the plot where he is there to sort of elicit confessions and monologues from the clients of this company to sort of reveal their hidden true desires.
Yeah. So it's a similar feel, I guess, in some ways to this character from The Manchurian Candidate and also a wonderful mustache.
Yes.
We also have a character named John. We don't know his last name. He's just John. We'll discuss his role and everything in a bit. But he's played by Wesley Addy, who lived 1913 through 1996. Stage and screen actor, best known for 1955's Kiss Me Deadly, 1970's Tora, 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 and 1976's Network. All right, moving outside of the company here, we have another character, or not completely outside of the company, but another character we encounter is a character named Charlie, and he's played by Murray Hamilton, who lived 1923 through 1986, stage and screen actor who might not be as recognizable to many in this film, but Joe, where do you know this guy from?
Oh, this is the mayor from Jaws, in a way playing the same kind of squirrely scammer he is in Jaws.
Yep. This is Mayor Vaughn from the first two Jaws movies. He was also Mr. Robinson in 67's The Graduate and Father Ryan in the Amityville Horror from 1979.
It is weird seeing him without one of his signature blazers from Jaws. By the way, if you've never noticed in Jaws before, the jackets that Mayor Vaughn wears, they are, words can't even describe, just chef kiss. I want them all in my closet. One of them is an anchor print. It's just got little anchors all over it. And another one is, Rob, look at the one with the parallel lines. I don't even know how to describe this.
Wow. I would be very surprised if someone's not putting these out again now, because I'm served ads of late for reproductions of like shirt prints from like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and other films. Like this is like people have realized that people just want to wear that shirt. So how long until this blazer with all the anchors on it is out? When people realize, hey, as I settle into to late middle age, I wanna start wearing jackets like the mayor from Jaws does.
Yeah. Amity, as you know, means friendship.
All right. The music in this film is by Jerry Goldsmith, who lived 29 through 2004. His work has come up on Weird House previously, I believe in the Congo episode and in the Gremlins 2 episode. So I won't go really deep here or anything, but suffice to say, a very successful and prolific film composer. And I think this score hits all the right notes. It leans into the melodrama where that's appropriate and certainly into the paranoia.
I agree. I think this is a very strong score. It really does help drive home the paranoia. But another thing, probably the thing that more than anything else really sets the tone of paranoia, is the excellent cinematography.
That's right. And this is the work of James Wong Howe. Howe lived 1899 through 1976. And he's actually the reason this film initially popped up on my radar. That was because I was reading about notable Asian American film industry folks, and James Wong Howe is considered one of the best cinematographers of all time, a real master of shadow, was highly sought after for multiple decades, ultimately earned 10 Oscar nominations, including for this film, and won two of them. They're only like, when I was looking into him, I was like, well, hopefully this guy did some weird films, something that we could discuss for Weird House Cinema. And out of all the movies he did, I think only two or three classify, but this was one of them, and I'm glad we went with this one.
Another one, I think, was Mark of the Vampire, right? Which is a vampire movie famous for having kind of a Scooby-Doo ending.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Todd Browning. It's supposed to look gorgeous. 1935 has a great cast, but I don't think it's the Todd Browning film we need to watch. So this one was, I think, the right choice for James Wong Howe.
Yeah, I haven't seen that other movie, but you can't be disappointed with his work on this one. It's just amazing.
So Howe was born in China, but his father went to work in America for the Northern Pacific Railway and eventually was able to bring his family over as well. I think Howe would have been four or five at the time. His father eventually ran a general store in Washington State, and Howe got his young hands on an Eastman Kodak Brownie camera, which I'm to understand was kind of like this was where things would begin, his interest in photography and ultimately cinematography. Now, as he grew older, he tried his hand at a few different career paths, but eventually worked his way into first commercial photography and then cinematography in L.A. during the silent film era. He did assistant camera and clapper work as early as 1919, but served as cinematographer for the first time on 1923's Drums of Fate, due apparently in part to star Mary Miles Minter, who took note of Howe's technical ability, capturing, I believe, the darkness in her eyes. He had some trick for photographing her just the right way, and she's like, well, this is the guy. This is who I want to work with. And work he did. He worked steadily throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s and became highly sought after, working with such directors as Howard Hawks, again, Todd Browning. He worked on such films as 1934's The Thin Man. He was also the uncredited cinematographer on those orchestra segments in Disney's Fantasia in 1940.
Oh, okay.
He made numerous technological innovations as well and ultimately cemented his place as an innovator and master, particularly of shadow as well as deep focus cinematography. Now, in many respects, yeah, his is a great Chinese-American success story, but it's also essential to realize a lot of what he was up against. He couldn't obtain U.S. citizenship till the 1940s due to the Chinese Exclusion Act, which ran from 1882 through 1943. And he also could neither legally marry or publicly acknowledge his wife, Sonora Babb, until the 1950s due to California laws against interracial marriage and the moral clause of his studio contract, which, you know, I think that the basic idea is there. He couldn't legally marry her. And then due to the moral clause of his contract, he could not, like, publicly be in a relationship with her, that sort of thing.
Mm.
Then, during the years of the Hollywood blacklist, his wife was blacklisted for alleged communist sympathies, and Howe himself was graylisted. This forced them to move to Mexico for a period, Though year by year, his output seemed to remain pretty steady by the look of things. So, one way or another, he was still finding projects to work on. Other films of note that he worked on include 1956's The Rose Tattoo. This was his first Oscar win. 1958's The Old Man and the Sea. 1963's Hud. That's also one that won him an Oscar. 1968's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. 1970's The Molly Maguires. And 1975's Funny Lady. This was his last film for which he was also nominated for an Oscar. He also has 8 directorial credits to his name, including 1954's Go Man Go and 1958's Invisible Danger. But again, his work in this film is just tremendous. I think if you've never seen a film that he worked on, like, this is a perfect starting place.
Absolutely, yeah. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
All right, we ready to talk about the plot?
Let's do it.
All right, so I found myself thinking we probably shouldn't do a detailed scene-by-scene recap of this one like we do in some episodes. Actually, this movie got me thinking about which movies feel right for that and which ones don't. Somehow I think it's the campier or sillier outings that really invite the more minute scene-by-scene treatment, and the for some reason the more weighty and serious dramas don't. I don't know exactly know why that is, but that does seem to be the general trend.
A lot of times we kind of breathe life into the spaces where there's not life. And and a film like this, it's like all the spaces are occupied. All the spaces are meaningful, and they don't necessarily need us to interpret them.
Exactly. So something would feel kind of cheap, I think, about looking at it too closely. So instead, we're going to zoom in and zoom out a little bit. But one place I do want to start zoomed in is the very beginning with the opening credits, where we have dissonant mechanical music, almost like the sound of a kind of scanning device emitting a signal that there is something being detected right here. It made me think of the motion trackers in Aliens, but I don't know, so some kind of music like that. And then you also have dark, moody strings and minor chords on the organ. Again, this is a score by Jerry Goldsmith. Kind of reminds me in a way of some of Howard Shore's music for like David Cronenberg movies.
Yeah.
That would come later, of course. And throughout the credit sequence, we have extreme close-ups on human facial features with a kind of funhouse mirror effect. Everything is warped and inverting upon itself, lips, teeth, ears, eyes. And then there's one part that's kind of funny with the name Rock Hudson appearing across the sclera of a tortured eyeball. And then finally, a face covered in cloth wrapping, almost like a ski mask, but I think it is supposed to be bandages.
Now, it's of note that the one and only Saul Bass is credited with the titles here. He, of course, directed Phase 4, the ant movie that we discussed on the show previously, though to just call it an ant movie is almost a disservice. That was his one and only feature directing credit, but the man's main bread and butter was this sort of work.
Yeah, like main titles and credit sequences and stuff, mm-hmm. posters as well.
Yeah, and these are great. But again, but kind of to your point, if you don't want to look up anybody's nose or into someone's ear, if that's like a real turnoff for you, you might want to skip this section of the movie.
Well, if you got that kind of constitution, you might just not want to watch Seconds.
Yeah.
So the movie begins, you were speaking earlier about the paranoid cinematography, and there's a great example of that right at the beginning. The movie begins with a man moving through a train station. I think it's actually Grand Central Station.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And there is a type of shot that I believe occurs several times in the film where the camera is kind of floating over the man's shoulder from behind and following him very tightly as he moves. It's almost like it's glued to him. And this has, for some reason, a very unsettling paranoid effect. It's like the feeling of an unseen spirit chasing and observing your every move.
Yeah, absolutely. This movie doesn't play around with these the feeling of something unsettling about the nature of reality.
And so it's following this man through a train station. We see this man moving and then another man who's always sort of photographed from the middle of the face up, I believe, with like the brim of his hat down in a kind of sinister way, following behind him. So the man who's walking ahead turns out to be our protagonist, Arthur Hamilton. And the stranger who's following him follows him through the crowd, down the stairs, all the way onto a train, and then suddenly calls out his name and hands him an address written on a piece of paper, and then departs, leaving Arthur just standing there on the train, baffled. What is this?
Yeah, like the whole setup, it's like, what's going to happen? Is someone going to be stabbed or shot? No, there's a handoff of a note. And somehow that makes it all the more sinister because you know, especially from the individual's reaction, like there's something really wrong about what just happened. Nothing good will come of this.
I guess we should take a moment to describe Arthur, the man here. What is his vibe?
Well, it's like we kind of discussed earlier, he is a vessel, an unleaking vessel, straining with all sorts of uncomfortable emotions. He is not comfortable in his own flesh, in his own body. He's a man in his, to be 100% accurate, I mean, the actor himself was in his early 50s at this point, though it's 1950s, early 50s, which is kind of a different animal than we tend to have nowadays. You know, a lot is said and commented upon regarding like differences in aging or seemingly there are differences in aging, et cetera.
I think the way he plays it and the way he's made up and photographed just makes him feel older than he actually is.
Yeah.
So we learn a bit about Arthur's life. We see him interacting with his wife. We see him at work. He is a moderately successful man in middle age. He's a banker. He obviously has a steady income and some accumulated wealth. He has a very nice home. He has a wife and an adult daughter who is out of the home now. She lives with her husband in another state. And yet he seems rather unhappy with his life. And this doesn't come from overt expressions of emotion, but rather from kind of what is unsaid and his something kind of straining underneath the surface. We see him at his job where he obviously makes a very good living. It seems he could hardly complain about that. And yet he is just clearly bored with his work and preoccupied. We see scenes of Arthur and his wife, Emily, interacting. And there's an interesting approach here. I feel like a lesser film might have made their relationship more strife-ridden or more strained, but they don't fight. They're not overtly unhappy. They are basically loving and supportive of one another, but there's something kind of intangible missing. You get the sense that their marriage is basically celibate and that he reads this in a way that's just kind of gray and disappointing.
Yeah, like he's not, like a lesser film would have also made him just completely cold. And it's not quite what's going on. There's this sense of like, I feel like I should want to, and yet I cannot, sort of thing. You know, it's complex.
And in the middle of all this, Arthur has begun receiving strange phone calls in the middle of the night, calls that claim to be from someone he knows, from his old friend, Charlie, who played, they played tennis together when they were in college. And at first this seems impossible because Charlie died several years before. But one night, the man claiming to be Charlie gets Arthur talking, and he provides all kinds of private details that no one would have any way of knowing. It has to be Charlie, but how could he be back from the dead? Well, Charlie tells Arthur to go to the address the man on the train gave him. He sort of like gives him this this exhortation. I think I don't recall exactly. I think he also sort of implies like, you've got to do it for me. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail about this, but this does lead to a kind of hunt sequence where Arthur decides that he does have to go find this place, this address, and he goes to like this laundromat where he's asking around about it. I liked this whole sequence because it's not exactly easy to find the thing that Arthur is looking for, and he doesn't even know what it is he's looking for. He's looking for an unknown, and yet he's going to all these lengths to find it.
Yeah, and really going through, you know, the underbelly of the world here, like the laundromat, where you know where the garments are washed and pressed, and there's steam and sweat going through. Then there's this whole scene where they're going through this like meat processing place, where you know obviously big slabs of meat is taking place, animals are being processed, and people are walking around and in smocks, you know, and the whole time we're like, oh my God, what's going to happen, Arthur? Should you really be walking in? I don't want to say confidently because he doesn't really do anything with confidence, but it's a very sinister aura to everything.
I think the significance of the meat packing plant as the gateway to his final destination will make a lot more sense once you see the end of the film.
Yeah.
So eventually Arthur meets someone who knows what he's looking for, and they sort of like, they load him into the back of a truck because he can't see where he's going, and he is transported into the bowels of some large building with no windows to the heart of a secretive organization, and they have a proposition for him. They say, Arthur, what if you could have another chance at life? In fact, we know that you are unhappy with your life. You are not satisfied. What if you could start over somewhere else and have the life that you really wanted, that you know you should have had to begin with? This company claims they can give that to you. Now, they charge a very hefty fee. They're going to take, I think they say it's $30,000, which is a lot in the money of the time. But they can do this impossible thing. They will stage your death, freeing you from your family and work obligations, and they will give you advanced plastic surgery, basically full body plastic surgery, to completely transform your identity and appearance so they can take this bored middle-aged man and his boring gray life and transform him into the man he wishes he could be. Now, there's an interesting ripple here because at first Arthur seems very hesitant. But they say, well, we know everybody actually wants this, but they're going to feel unable to say yes. So to help you along with your decision, we have removed that choice for you with the help of blackmail. So they say, when you first arrived, we drugged you and we took photos staging a fake sexual assault with you as the perpetrator. And if you try to leave, we'll release the photos. So you have no choice. You have to say yes. But this is presented as, well, we're doing you a favor because we know you want to agree to this. You just don't feel like you can. Now you don't have a choice.
Yeah. It's like, we both know you want to leave this lot in a new car. To help you out, we went ahead and set your old car on fire.
Yes.
And all of this is played very well. Like, you can see just how uncomfortable and afraid he becomes at this. And the whole setup for it is also like hypnotic and disturbing. So already we're well into the Twilight Zone here.
Right. But despite all of his hesitation and fear, Arthur does agree. So he undergoes plastic surgery and then a serious rehabilitation course and is transformed from his boring, doughy, middle-aged self into Rock Hudson, a lithe, dashingly handsome and glamorous man. And he's given a full new identity. He's a man called Antiochus Wilson. Now, of course, since the company faked his death and committed all this fraud, he has to keep his past life absolutely secret. So he can't go around saying, you know, I used to be this other guy. He has to just pretend all he is Antiochus Wilson. That other life never existed. During this process, he undergoes therapy sessions to sort of, I think it's to uncover his true desires. And there's a theme that emerges during these therapy sessions that'll come up a couple of times in the film where I think they put him under hypnosis and record the things he's talking about. And before he gets into talking about the things that they try to actualize, there are moments where he kind of regresses into childhood desires and he keeps talking about a big red ball. So there's this establishment of a theme that becoming free to actually seek one's true desires is in a way a kind of regression into more and more immature objects of desire. But they find through all this process that Arthur actually always had an interest in painting. We find out later that he sort of had a watercolor hobby. You know, he would do little paintings, but he never got to really pursue this because, of course, you know, he's trying to have a serious career as a banker. So they set him up as a professional painter with a house on the West Coast, and they send him off to settle into his new life where he has like a butler or a valet. I think the guy's name is John. Is that right?
This is John, the Silver Fox.
Yes, the butler who is provided by the company, who attends to all of his needs. He's got this nice, swanky house. He lives on the beach. He has this exciting, glamorous life where he can do whatever he wants. And he has all these friends and he has this exciting career with actual artistic fulfillment. Now he gets to be the painter that he thinks he really should have been. He also meets an exciting woman, a woman named Nora Marcus, played by Salome Jens. And she's like a free spirit who also left her previous life behind. Of course, he can't admit that he did this. They meet and get to know one another and they bond. And eventually there's a scene where they attend like a literal bacchanal together. A bunch of hippies get naked and they're like chugging wine and playing musical instruments and stomping on grapes in a big vat.
Yeah, some obvious jazz cigarettes being smoked.
Yes.
At this event. I can come back to one second for the whole idea of them setting him up as an artist. There was one of the many scenes where the company men are talking him through what's going to happen. There was one scene in particular I thought was really good because they're showing him the paintings that they have provided that they're setting him up with his portfolio of his previous work and talking about, you know, and then you'll change up your style a bit and you'll do something different. He has some hesitation about this, you know, because he's like, I don't have that level of ability. And they're like, it doesn't matter because you will be established. And I thought that was very chilling and kind of cutting. One of the many moments in the film that, you know, isn't about like, you know, high levels of anxiety or fear, but it's just very solid.
I totally agree. And in fact, I think we see it with like the wild, the bacchanalia, the party lifestyle, and with his supposedly fulfilling artistic career. In both of these cases, we sense that despite him, quote, getting what he wants, something is very wrong and very empty with this life. There's a scene where he paints, and the scene is just painful. Because, as you said earlier, they establish his reputation as an artist by buying paintings done by someone else, faking them as his, passing them off as his, and now he gets to paint. But when he goes to paint, it's obvious he's not happy doing it. Like, he may have been happy in his previous life doing his little amateur watercolors, but now that he is supposed to be a serious painter, and he realizes he's not like satisfied with the paintings that he can produce with his own hand, something is very like gnawing at him about this.
Yeah, it's like it's been taken out of like the organic pattern of his life, and now it's presented in this unnatural state, and therefore it's not fulfilling because the things that made it fulfilling and made it desirable, all of those conditions have been removed.
He may have not been able to be a painter professionally, but in his other life, when he was painting, at least that was an honest pursuit. And now it's all a fraud.
Yeah.
So that emptiness comes through in the painting scene, but there are also the scenes where he has these parties where he, is drinking and doing drugs and, you know, having this exciting lifestyle, but then he gets drunk and he blabs about his previous life.
Oh boy, does he get drunk. This is such a, like, these are such cringy scenes. Like, I'm tempted to compare them to, like, something you would see on I Think You Should Leave.
Yes, yeah.
But without the comedy, you know, just like that level
just
of
painful.
Like, you're just painful to watch. I mean, it's beyond like, oh, he's a funny drunk he's just like he gets sloppy drunk where you characters are trying to say you shouldn't drink anymore or you should leave. And he keeps going.
And there is a scene where at one point he gets drunk and he starts blabbing about his previous life. And some people from the party have to grab him and take him into his bedroom and explain to him, you need to keep your mouth shut. Because it turns out all of his new friends, they're not necessarily like organic friends. Most of these people at the party, maybe not all of them, are also people living second lives.
Yeah, they're also the reborn.
Yes, they're also reborns. And they're like, you're going to spoil this for all of us. If like the company gets exposed, if we get found out too, you got to shut up. And you got to think that also sort of cheapens it for him, right? That like all of his so-called friends are also frauds.
Yeah.
So this leads to a break where he ends up going back to visit his wife as Rock Hudson. He doesn't say like, hey, you know, I'm your husband, remember me. She is still going on under the impression that her husband died in a fire in a hotel room, which is what the company staged for him. And Rock Hudson, he pretends to be a friend of her late husband's. And so he goes to visit the house and speaks to her. I think he's like, hey, you know, I'm a painter and I wanted to paint a portrait of your husband because he was a friend of mine. And he also asks about the watercolors. He's like, you know, your husband's watercolors, do you still have them? And it's interesting. There's an unresolved thing from this conversation. I wonder what you made of this where she's like, oh, the watercolors. Yeah. And he's like, did you get rid of them? And she says, not exactly.
Yeah, I was expecting there to be some follow up, like maybe she donated them somewhere or they were painted over. I don't know. Because in a sense, I mean, his life has been painted over. Right. But yeah, we don't get the second beat on that, really.
But she actually in the scene has insights about her late husband. Very cutting ones, the kind of thing that, you know, she never would have said to him when she thought he was alive. And she says that she thinks he spent his life trying to acquire what he had been taught to want, you know, a good job, a steady income, a nice home, a family. And yet he was deeply unsatisfied. She says that it was like there was something he always wanted to say, but he couldn't say it. He was just holding it in. And in the background in this scene, we know that now he's gotten all of the things that he yearned for when he was unsatisfied with his previous life, the life he had when he pursued what he had been taught to want. So there's the second order thing, the things he thinks he really wanted, his genuine wants, good looks, glamour, artistic expression, excitement, sex, drugs, bacchanalia. And yet we can tell that he is not at all happy by acquiring these things either. There is a deep hollowness and fraudulence and anxiety at the core of his new existence. So his wife sends him away with a memento of her late husband. It's his tennis trophy, which is a callback to a scene earlier where when his friend Charlie called him on the phone and said, hey, you know, this is really me. You can know because look on the underside of our tennis trophy from the doubles tournament. We carved this into the bottom. I think it's like, Fidelis Eternia or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Antiochus Wilson leaves the house, he is picked up by John, the valet from the company, in a car. And he says, I want to go back. And John says, of course, sir. He says, no, no, no. I don't mean to California. I want to go back to the company. I want to start again. Again. Is it possible? Antiochus Wilson can die, can't he? And John says, I think that can be arranged, sir.
Sir.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
So they go back to the company, and here Rock Hudson meets with his caseworker, and they explain to him, yeah, we can set you up with a new life. Once again, you know, sometimes this happens. People are not satisfied with their second life. They need another. But before we do that, we do need you to do something for us. We would ask you to sponsor someone else for our program, someone you know. Obviously, you know, you must know tons of people who would be good candidates. We just need you to give us a name, somebody we can get in touch with, and we might need you to stay on hand to help them, maybe make some phone calls to them to make sure that that they end up in our care. And this makes sense because they can't what they do is illegal. They can't advertise on the news in the newspaper. They have to operate on a personal referral basis. And here it becomes clear there was a payoff of a waiting room that Arthur Hamilton went into earlier in the movie that's full of men just sitting around playing cards, reading books, hanging out, just seemingly waiting, you know, whiling away the hours. Here we meet Murray Hamilton, and it turns out this is Arthur Hamilton's old friend, Charlie, the guy from school, except, of course, he looks nothing like him. He has had a second life. He is a reborn by this company, but it turned out he also needed another chance. He also needed to start over again, but he couldn't do that until he fulfilled his duty for referring Arthur Hamilton here. And they'd had him on hand so he could continue making phone calls to him and helping him get settled in.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a great vibe with the day room, because we saw the day room earlier and we saw everyone. It looked like more like they were working or studying. And now we realize they're just passing the time. And we also see that they're being given little cups of medication to help them pass the time. And that it's this kind of limbo between lives, with all of them clearly are waiting for their next chance to get their third life or perhaps their fourth or fifth, who knows?
Yeah, you don't know how many times. But now finally the mayor from Jaws is going to get another shot. He blew the last one for some reason. It is not what he wanted. So he's going to get another one. But now this is where Rock Hudson is stuck. And so they say, okay, that's fine. We can give you another one, but we do need you to refer somebody first. And the problem is he refuses. He's like, I can't think of anybody to refer. I'm sorry. And he's really hung up on he's got to have another chance at a new life, because he He screwed up the first one. You know, he just wanted what people taught him to want. The second time he wanted something else, but he didn't do it right. Something wasn't right about it. But he'll, the third time, then he'll get it. Then he'll really fulfill his desires.
Yeah. He expresses that he, this on the second life, he also didn't have input in it. Like the first life, he didn't have input into what he should want. And the second time around, like what did they do? They kind of drug some things out of him during hypnosis, constructed something for him, and then put him into that slot. And so he kind of, he felt ultimately trapped and in an artificial place once more. And he thinks, well, this next time I want lots of input into it. I have ideas. Let's work together so that this can work.
But they keep asking him, you know, we got to get a referral. You got to give us somebody. And he doesn't. He's just like, I can't think of anybody. So then we are finally let, after he refuses multiple times, he's led to another meeting with the old man played by Will Gear, who he spoke to earlier the first time he was in the building belonging to the company. Will Gear is very good in this role because he's very folksy and he's very soft-spoken and he's just like a sweet, sweet old man who talks about his dream of giving people what they really want. He knows that so many people live lives of kind of quiet misery that they just can't really commit to living the lives they know they should be living. And he wanted to create the opportunity for people to have that chance. But then he also gets a little real. He's like, you know, so that is the ideal under which I started the company. But the fact is, you know, now we have a lot of employees and we got to make payroll and we have shareholders and we've got to meet our obligations to shareholders. So if we don't have an ongoing, you know, basis of new referrals coming in, we really can't keep doing what we're doing. In order to make the dream work, we got to have money coming in. So you got to refer somebody.
Yeah. And the dream, again, is basically, as he puts it, is to end human suffering. Like he has this, and I think that's one of the great things about the old man particularly, but the company as a whole, while there's almost everything about it is sinister and at times very cold and very, also very, you know, corporate and so forth. It is presented as if like at, in its roots anyway, it is trying to help people.
Will Gear, yeah, he at least thinks he is trying to help people. But then, of course, you know, once you start a business, it kind of has it has hungers of its own. Like you gotta keep the lights on. So they need the referrals, and he doesn't give them the referrals. So they're like, okay, well, that's all right. And then this leads up to the ending, the shocking, horrifying ending, where they strap Rock Hudson to a gurney. He thinks he is being taken off to his next plastic surgery to get a whole new face, a whole new body, a whole new identity again. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, no, they are taking him off to become one of the cadavers that will be used to fake the death of a new applicant.
Yeah. Oh, God. It really builds up too, because at first he's like, where are we going? We're going to my surgery. It's too soon because, you know, we didn't talk through all the details. You know, I have ideas. You guys have ideas. You know, I want to make sure we're doing it right this time. And they're reassuring him. But then as they're going, and it's fabulously shot, this strange hallway that they're going down. I can only imagine that some of the gurney scenes in Jacob's Ladder that would come many years later are perhaps referring back to this sequence. Because, you know, at first he's just expressing his, you know, concerns over it. And then it becomes clear that this priest, perhaps, that is speaking to him is basically administering last rites.
Yes. It is hard for me to communicate how chilling the last few minutes of this movie are. One of the most shocking, unsettling things I've ever seen in film.
Yeah, because when he begins to realize what's really happening, he begins to struggle. They jump, they like strap his mouth closed, and he continues to fight and scream horribly for what feels like 15 minutes or so. Ugh. It's a lot as they drag him off to the death room. And I kept thinking, well, they're going to stop. We're going to fade away or cut away as they roll him into that room. Yeah. And they don't. We go into the death room with him. And there is the doctor from earlier, his plastic surgeon. And he explains, you know, like, yeah, you were my best work. I really nailed it.
I made a looks. Rock Hudson out of you.
I make Rock Hudson out of you. And I hate to see this work, go down the drain. And then we follow the scene right through the cranial drilling of our main character as they drill the life out of him. And we get like the final sort of like death desire hallucination. And it is a scene, presumably either him and his daughter on the beach with a red ball, or perhaps it is some other scene. Maybe you can interpret it as him and a parental unit on the beach with a red ball. It's abstract like that. But like this, I guess, was the true desire. You know, this was, deep down in him, like this is the most honest part, the purest part of his life. And it's the last thing we see.
You know, it made me think about how, so once I saw the ending, I was like, oh, okay, now I think I understand, because the ending of the movie feels so bad. Mm-hmm. I understand why some people hated this movie and thought it was like cold and awful. I think it's actually quite brilliant, but I think the film, and I'm not at all saying it should have done this, I'm just saying imagining a different movie that could have been, I think the ending would have felt very different if there was some character in it somewhere who got it, who figured out what the correct desire is, the desire that that one can have in order to find true happiness. And the movie does not give an answer on that. It shows you lots of failures of wisdom and failures to understand ourselves and the pitfalls of desire and the hollowness of desire, but it never shows you the right way. It never provides the solution. So you know, you're not given like that sort of ladder out of the pit of despair.
Yeah, there's no Buddha in this film. And I thought for a little bit they were setting our main character up to be a kind of Buddha, that he would realize that essentially in the day room, you have these characters that are going in and out of incarnations. It's very much like the Buddhist wheel of samsara, in the realization that like everything is just a cycle of life and death and rebirth, and that the only way to find true liberation is to remove yourself from that cycle. Mm-hmm. But there is no such revelation in this film, because ultimately he's like, give me another shot. I think the next shot is it. I think the next shot will be better. And he just commits to the wheel. And that is his undoing.
Well, in a way, I think this film is extremely compatible with Buddhist ideals. Like, I think that is sort of the wisdom of the movie, but there's no character who embodies that realization. You only see the characters who fail and just like, are slavering after their next desire.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all hungry ghosts.
So the ending is bleak, dark, shocking. It does not feel good at all, but I think it's quite powerful. And I want to make clear again, I don't think I would change it. I don't think I would prefer the film with the character who does get it or does embody sort of the wisdom of the movie's message.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's perfect as is. I like the direction they ended up going in. I didn't even look into it. I'm assuming this is the basic direction of the novel as well, but perhaps it goes in a different direction. I'm also a little shocked that no one has remade this film, or certainly maybe not as a motion picture, but it seems like the kind of thing that someone could pick up for some sort of a television series, you know, especially nowadays, thinking of the success of things like Severance and so forth. There's a lot you could do with Seconds. But on the other hand, as we often say with films that really nail something, I don't really want to see someone else come in and perhaps screw it up. This film doesn't need to be reborn. As I mentioned the other day, my one caveat would be this would have made a great Treehouse of Horror episode. If The Simpsons had done a send-up of this with Homer Simpson, or I don't know, there are various other Simpsons characters that might have been ideal for this treatment, but I can imagine at least the old days of the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, they could have done this up really nicely.
First life, you're Ned Flanders. Second life, you're Troy McClure. Third life, you know, you refer Homer and you get to go be somebody else. You get to be Otto finally.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is Seconds from 1966. Terrific picture. Not for the weak of heart. Not for someone expecting just kind of an easygoing psychological horror film. This one has a lot going on in it. So obviously we'd love to hear anyone's thoughts out there about the film. What's your interpretation of its message? What do you think about some of the choices here in the performance and the cinematography and so forth? Write in. We'd love to hear from you. We discuss listener mail from everything we do here in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed on our Monday listener mail episodes. Our core science episodes air on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Wednesdays, we do a short form monster fact or artifact episode. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns, even though it's a pretty serious movie in many respects, for Weird House Cinema. And if you want to see a full list of the movies we've covered over the years here, you can go to letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. We have an account there. Our username is Weird House, and you'll find a list of everything we've covered. And that website allows you to do a lot of really cool things too, like organized by decades and years and genres. So check it out. It's a neat little tool.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.